Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Not Just a Lawyer podcast. This is episode 1 of season 5, and it concerns breaking news, which is the decision of the ACT Supreme Court's Acting Justice Kay in the matter of Drumgold and the Board of Inquiry and others. Citation is 2024 ACT SC 58, and a decision was handed down today in this civil law matter. I'll be talking mostly about a particularly interesting aspect of this matter, which is a look at apprehended bias. Now, we've talked about that before on the podcast, and you might remember that apprehended bias is something that needs to be looked at case by case. You can't establish a hard and fast rule on something that will be apprehended bias in every circumstance. And there's some pretty sound reasons for that, which Acting Justice Kay talks through in his judgment. So I'll be focusing on those issues, but I will give a little update on the overall outcome of that matter as well, not just about the apprehended bias aspects. I'm recording this podcast on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people. I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and I acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded. To give a little background, this case relates to findings made by the Commission of Inquiry into the Criminal Justice System in ACT. Many of you will be aware that because of perceived problems arising during the criminal trial of Bruce Lehman in relation to alleged sexual assault of Brittany Higgins, that there were concerns raised by the former Director of Public Prosecutions about police conduct. Police in turn were concerned about the former Director of Public Prosecutions, and a Commission of Inquiry was opened. In summary, the Commission of Inquiry led to adverse findings being made in relation to the former Director of Public Prosecutions, and those findings made his position untenable and he resigned from that role. If you would like a really good background on that and some commentary that I'm not prepared to go into because it makes me feel a bit uncomfortable, to be honest, because I have interacted with a lot of the people involved, then I would highly recommend The Wigs, which is a podcast, season 6, episode 1. It touches on the findings of the Sofronoff inquiry. Now, I'll talk about those a little bit in the context of the decision that was made today by Acting Justice Kay, but mostly, I'll be focusing on the issue of apprehended bias. And if you want to have a little bit more regard to what the findings in relation to the former DPP were, I highly recommend that Wigs podcast. It's great. So first, it's probably a good idea to just briefly let you know what kind of proceedings these were in the ACT Supreme Court. And in short, this was a judicial review. So Mr. Drumgold, the former DPP of the Australian Capital Territory, was applying for judicial review of findings by the Board of Inquiry. Those findings related to certain things that he was alleged to have done during the preparation for and the conduct of the trial of Mr. Lehman. And I believe there was also some scrutiny of conduct following that trial as well, such as looking at media statements that he made, or a particular media statement where he spoke about the character of Ms. Higgins, and also in relation to a letter that he wrote to, I believe it was the chief police officer, which expressed concerns, and those concerns and the corresponding concerns that police held because of that letter being written to them and also reported upon in newspapers. Those things led to this inquiry being established. So in relation to the Board of Inquiry itself, while it may seem extremely weird, that inquiry's findings don't have any legal effect. They don't cause a penalty to happen. They're not like getting a conviction of something. They're not like getting a disciplinary finding. They're not like having a license revoked. All they are findings, and then it's up to the Attorney General and other parties in the community to determine what's going to happen, what use, if any, will be made of those findings. So we know that the Attorney General considered that the findings made it not possible, really, for the former DPP to stay in that role and be able to do his job and be trusted in that role because of the findings of the Board of Inquiry. And as a result of having that communicated to him, the DPP resigned. And that process is outlined in the decision written and released today by Acting Justice Kay. That's not me speculating or having any insider knowledge. It is literally from the words of this judgment. So because this is not in relation to a finding that had a legal effect, the remedy available to Mr. Drumgold on any aspects of the case that he is successful in is declaratory relief, which is a pretty unusual form of relief in terms of what many of us would really typically come across. A lot of us, I think, are aware that courts can award compensation. They might make an injunction to stop something from happening. Declaratory relief might not be something that we've come across that often. So I'll just give you a teeny tiny brief bit of information about declaratory relief, just so that we all understand what this unusual remedy is. So declaratory relief is essentially declaring something. So what the judge now has to do, and he's asked the parties to help him do this, so this is not actually part of his judgment, he has to make a declaration that reflects the findings that he has made. So he has found that a fair-minded observer would reasonably apprehend that the commissioner of the Board of Inquiry held bias in relation to the former DPP. The judge will then have to find some wording that suitably conveys that. Basically, yes, I find that there has been a reasonable apprehension of bias for these reasons. That's basically it. So it's basically a declaration. I say something to be true. You're declaring it. That's why it's declaratory relief. My example of what might be said is pretty inelegant because I don't think with my lawyer brain all that much anymore, so I'm pretty much out of practice. Plus, as I confess, I really haven't had any involvement in matters seeking declaratory relief. So you'll have to forgive me there, but now we all know what it means. So that's very nice. So a number of adverse findings were made in relation to the former DPP about his actions before, during and after the prosecution of Bruce Lehman in relation to alleged sexual assault of Brittany Higgins. And ultimately, Acting Justice Kay didn't find that many of those had problems attached to them. And I will go into a bit more detail about that just so that you understand what I'm talking about, which is the obvious point of this podcast. But I don't want to go chapter and verse into what the findings actually were. Again, I would refer you to the excellent episode of the Whigs that I referred to earlier. That'll take you through what the findings actually were. I want to focus mostly on apprehended bias, but I do want to give a brief but fair rendering or description of what the judgment held overall. Basically, in very, very tight terms, so that I don't take up much time with it, the former DPP was asking for declaratory relief in relation to a couple of things. And when I say a couple of things, a few issues, but let me tell you, the judgment itself deals with all of these things in minute detail. So while there may be a few issues being raised, there is so much to be considered, which is why I'm not going into those chapter and verse, and I will be pretty much just focusing on the apprehended bias part of the matter. So the chief complaints being made are that in some respects, in relation to some of the adverse findings made about him, the former DPP wasn't afforded natural justice, and that in relation to some of the findings against him, there wasn't a proper basis to make those findings, and then that the chair of the inquiry, Mr. Sofronov, engaged in communication with a journalist from The Australian, Ms. Janet Albrechtson, which the fair-minded lay observer would consider gave them an apprehension of bias. Apprehended bias means I apprehend that there is bias. Apprehend in this sense kind of means believe, notice, worry about, like I've perceived something and I think that it could be happening. The root of the word apprehension is apprehend. And so you'll see, you know, just that word gives you a bit of context. It's, yeah, I think something's happening, or I'm worried that something may have happened. And in relation to the legal system, as we've discussed so many times before on this podcast, one of the key things about the legal system is that people have confidence in it, having confidence that it is there to help people find justice, that it's fair. All of those things give the legal system legitimacy and make people able to rely on and feel some trust in the decisions that are made. So while the Board of Inquiry is not strictly the same as a court, and by not strictly, I mean it is not at all the same as a court, the findings that it was making do bear on people's trust of the legal system in the ACT. After all, it was an inquiry into criminal law in the ACT as arising in that particular prosecution. So very intimately connected. So really important that an apprehension of bias isn't something that happens in these kinds of matters. In brief, Acting Justice Kay found that there was a reasonable apprehension of bias, and I'm going to go into that and explain it much better than I am right now in a few minutes. So that was the key area upon which the former DPP succeeded, but he did have some success in aspects of the adverse findings against him and issues of natural justice, though his success in those areas was much more limited. He made a number of claims, I guess would be the word, in relation to failures of natural justice or the adverse findings that were made against him, and he didn't succeed on many of those, but he did succeed on some. So I might just take you to those first. We'll get them out of the way because I want to focus on apprehended bias, but I also want to be fair in setting out what the findings were. just in case you're interested more broadly in this matter. Now, looking at the judgment in greater depth, I'm first going to take you to the end of the judgment. So, Acting Justice K has put together a summary of conclusions. I'm going to talk to you about the conclusions in relation to claims of legal unreasonableness and a failure to accord natural justice. And then I'm going to go into greater depth on the claim that the conduct of the first defendant of the inquiry gave rise to a reasonable apprehension of bias. So, paragraph 597 of His Honour's judgment is about the claim for legal unreasonableness of some of the adverse findings that were made about the former DPP by the Board of Inquiry. And as I said before, if you want to know more about what these adverse findings were, the Wigs podcast is really good at going through those and is very interesting. So, the plaintiff submitted that 8 findings by the first defendant in the report of the inquiry were legally unreasonable. I have concluded that the plaintiff has not established that 7 of those findings were legally unreasonable. I have concluded that the finding by the first defendant that the plaintiff had engaged in grossly unethical conduct in his cross-examination of Senator Linda Reynolds was legally unreasonable. Accordingly, ground 3 succeeds in respect of that finding. So he argued that 8 findings were not reasonable, that is, that they were legally unreasonable. He succeeded in relation to only 1 of those claims. Okay, moving on to allegations of a failure to accord natural justice. In paragraph 598, Acting Justice K sets out, the plaintiff contended that the first defendant failed to accord him natural justice by failing to give him a fair hearing in respect of 3 findings made by the first defendant in the report. I have concluded that the plaintiff has not established a failure of natural justice in respect of 2 of those findings. I have concluded that the first defendant failed to afford the plaintiff natural justice in respect of the finding in the report that the plaintiff's statement to the chief police officer on 8 December 2022 concerning his knowledge about the Freedom of Information application relating to the 1 November 22 letter was false. Accordingly, ground 4 succeeds in respect of that finding. So, again, if you want to understand what these findings were, the Wigs report is very good. Or you can look at this judgment, of course. It is very detailed and very, very interesting. Basically, I will say the allegations about failure to afford natural justice, they mostly centered around the concept that if you're going to make an adverse finding about someone, you want to make sure that they understand the nature of that and have a chance to respond. So Acting Justice K found actually the plaintiff did know enough about the allegations and the fact that there were probably going to be adverse findings made in relation to some of them. He had enough info about those, but on this particular one, he didn't get enough info that an adverse finding was going to be made and why. So he didn't have a chance to defend himself against it. So he succeeded on that ground. And then the other ground, seeking declaratory relief, was that the conduct of the first defendant of the inquiry gave rise to a reasonable apprehension of bias. So I'm going to tell you the conclusion that was reached, and then I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about some of the things that led to that conclusion being drawn, just because they're very interesting. It's pretty unusual. Okay, so paragraph 596, in respect of ground 2, that the conduct of the first defendant of the inquiry gave rise to a reasonable apprehension of bias. I have concluded that the amount, context, nature, manner, and content of the communications that occurred between Mr. Sofronoff and Ms. Janet Ulbrichtson of the Australian newspaper were such that a fair-minded lay observer acquainted with the material objective facts might reasonably have apprehended that Mr. Sofronoff, in determining in chapters 4, 5, and 6 of the report the issues specified by paragraph C of the terms of reference of the inquiry might have been influenced by the views held and publicly expressed by Ms. Ulbrichtsen concerning the conduct by the plaintiff of the prosecution of the criminal proceedings against Mr. Lehrman. Accordingly, ground two of the application for judicial review must succeed. So that was a very, very wordy paragraph. But in summary, he found that a reasonable lay observer who had all the material objective facts before them might reasonably have apprehended that Mr. Sofronov, in doing his job, might have been influenced by Ms. Ulbrichtsen and her views of how the former DPP had done his job, basically. So, turns out, even though I don't think in lawyer speak all the time anymore, I am still good at translating legalese, so that's really good. So you'll notice, or you may not have, because it was a very wordy paragraph, but the amount, context, nature, manner, and content of the communications were such that a fair-minded lay observer, blah, 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 reasonably apprehended, blah, 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 influenced by Ms. Ulbrichtsen. So, yeah, there are specific things about this communication. Amount, context, nature, manner, content. So let's go back through the judgment and have a look at some examples that ultimately led Acting Justice Kay to conclude that the fair-minded lay observer might apprehend bias. Before I do that, I want to let you know that Acting Justice Kay goes through in depth at paragraph 218 of his judgment the principles in relation to apprehended bias, and he makes it really clear that each level of the test for reasonable apprehension, so reasonable apprehension or concern that there is bias, must be firmly established. The possibility of bias must be real and not merely remote. He also notes that it's really important to distinguish between what might be the tests and things that you think about in relation to courts versus what might give rise to a reasonable apprehension of bias in different kind of proceedings like a board of inquiry. The things that I think it's really good for you to know in particular about this test, and you know, His Honor goes through it at paragraph 218, the hypothetical fair-minded lay observer is assumed to know and understand both the nature of the proceeding and the material objective facts that relate to the processes undertaken by the decision maker. So in this consideration here, the hypothetical fair-minded lay observer needed to understand, when you imagine, could they apprehend bias reasonably? They know all of the details about what this board of inquiry is about. They get the gist of it very strongly. They understand it, they know it and understand it, and they know the material objective facts that relate to the processes undertaken by the decision maker. So they're pretty knowledgeable. They're not just someone who might have heard, you know, a report on the radio about it once and form an opinion. It's someone who is fair-minded. They're a lay observer, so they're not a lawyer, but they do understand and know quite a lot of things. So, I don't think it's any surprise that they are only hypothetical in that case. Just kidding. So, there were a lot of things that the judge considered when looking at whether the content, nature, amount, etc. of communications could lead the hypothetical fair-minded lay observer to apprehend that the decision maker, the board of inquiry, may have come at some of the decisions with bias or without an impartial mind. So let's look at some of those. We'll try and select some of the most interesting examples, but some of them are less flashy, but very illustrative of the deep thinking that His Honour had to do. But before I hit those highlights, I do want to say that His Honour made a really interesting comment at paragraph 2:21, he made it clear that the question that he is being asked to consider is about whether an apprehension of bias might have arisen in the hypothetical fair-minded lay observer. He says, this does not involve any consideration or determination whether the amount and nature of the contacts that occurred between Mr. Sofronoff and Ms. Ulbrichtsen were appropriate or prudent. That question does not involve any legal issue for determination in the present proceeding. Rather, the question is whether, as a consequence of those contacts, a fair-minded lay observer with knowledge of the material objective facts might reasonably apprehend that Mr. Sofronoff might not have brought an impartial mind to the resolution of the questions which came for determination before the inquiry relating to the conduct by the plaintiff of the prosecution of Mr. Lehman. So he's saying, not making any judgments aside from the legal ones that I am required to make in this case. In paragraph 8 of his judgment, Acting Justice Kay notes that the Board of Inquiry published Practice Guideline 01-2023 on 24 February 2023, and that was a guideline in relation to people who had evidence to provide, to submit that information or evidence to the board, and to do so by way of an email address that was given out, and that went to the executive director of the board. Any questions about the inquiry should be directed to the executive director at that email address. And clause 26 of the guideline provided that, subject to the chairperson's determination of any application for confidentiality, any information, witness statements, including exhibits to the statements, documents or submissions provided to the board, might be published in whole or in part on the inquiry's website or otherwise made publicly available. There was also a document called Media Protocols Guideline that was published by the first defendant. His Honour talks about this in his paragraph 9. He says that guideline prescribed a number of protocols for the conduct of media in the course of hearings and provided information as to how access might be obtained by media to those hearings, and his honour further points to clauses 3 and 14. These guidelines provide details of the arrangements for media access and reporting at hearings. The inquiry may vary or depart from these guidelines. And for media inquiries, please contact boi.information@inquiry.act.gov.au. So there was a clear way that people who had an interest in the proceedings or who thought they had an interest could put forward information to the inquiry via that first practice guideline that was to the same address, it turns out, as media inquiries. So His Honour points out that there was a clear guideline set out by the Board of Inquiry, which is pretty important for us to know because, His Honour, based on having to think about the hypothetical fair-minded lay observer, noted in paragraph 276 of his judgment, in considering those contacts and communications, the fair-minded observer would, of course, know as a material objective fact of the effect of the practice guideline and the media protocols guideline published by the first defendant on or about 24 February 2023. That is, the fair-minded observer would understand that, from its inception, the first defendant had established and had notified the public, including the media, of the means by which documents would be made available to members of the public. Further, the fair-minded observer would have in mind that the first defendant, from an early stage, had specified the protocols which would govern its communications with members of the media. He goes on at paragraph 277. In addition, the fair-minded observer would, in viewing the contacts between Mr. Sofronov and Ms. Ulbrichtsen, bear in mind that during the inquiry, the executive arm of the Board of Inquiry maintained a media distribution list by which it might communicate to members of the media as a whole. It would be relevant for the fair-minded observer to understand that for some reason, Ms. Ulbrichtsen's name and email address were not included on that list. So, noting that protocol, would you be surprised by paragraph 122 of the judgment, where His Honour is summarising the contents of an affidavit made by Mr. Sofronov for the judicial review proceedings setting out his recollections of things? So, His Honour said, on 25 July 2023, Ms. Ulbrichtsen asked by text whether Mr. Sofronov would give her a copy of the final report on an embargoed basis. That is, on the basis that the journalist would neither use nor publish its contents until she had authority to do so. On 28 July, Mr. Sofronov provided a draft copy of the report to Ms. Ulbrichtsen on that basis. On 30 July, he gave a final report. He gave a final version of the report to her on that basis. On that date, he also provided a copy of the report to the solicitor for Ms. Higgins. Further, paragraph 123. On 31 July, Mr. Sofronov handed a copy of his report to the Chief Minister and the Attorney General of the ACT. And so on and so on. So noting that there are those published guidelines in place, I think it is surprising that Mr. Sofronov was communicating by text with Ms. Ulbrichtsen. There are a number of other examples, and some of them are absolute crackers, though I felt very embarrassed reading some of them. I'm going to go to one of those because, oh my gosh, you couldn't make this stuff up. So I want you to just imagine the scariest prosecution that you can think of, something super duper high stakes. Well, if you were thinking something along the lines of the prosecution of the backpacker murderer, Ivan Milat, in this Board of Inquiry appearing for the former DPP, Mr. Drumgold, was Mark Tedeschi of King's Counsel, and he was the man who prosecuted Ivan Milat for murder. Now, let's hear what the exchange was in relation to Mr. Tedeschi. And believe me, I'll be shocked if some of the words that are used next don't get put on t-shirts and mugs, kept ironically and safely hidden away in legal officers and barristers' chambers around Australia. His Honour, at paragraph 298, talks about Ms. Ulbrichtsen communicating with Mr. Sofronov about matters before the inquiry. She sent a text to Mr. Sofronov asking whether the inquiry was looking into certain things. She thought that questions asked on a particular day weren't clear enough. Mr. Sofronov said, yes, he should have asked Moller yesterday what he understood by it. He'll do that this morning and follow up with Chu. And His Honour thought that was a very relevant text exchange because first, Ms. Ulbrichtsen felt free to communicate with Mr. Sofronov and express an opinion to him about the issues that were being agitated at the inquiry. Secondly, Mr. Sofronov saw fit to express to Ms. Ulbrichtsen his agreement with her suggestion as to a question that ought to have been asked of a witness. But now we get to the really face-crackingly, excruciatingly cringe part. Paragraph 300, His Honour says, On the same date, Ms. Olbrichtson sent a text message to Mr. Sofronov, stating that she was catching up on Moller and evidence and requesting whether she was permitted to know what had transpired during the muted, that is, closed, sections of the inquiry. In response, Mr. Sofronov sent a text message to Ms. Olbrichtson. I'll send you the transcript in the morning. Boring Tedeschi. So, that's nice. His Honour is scrupulously fair in setting out the relevant things from Mr. Sofronov's affidavit. He really readily acknowledges that Mr. Sofronov explained that he had the most contact with Ms. Olbrichtson because she was the most persistent in contacting him. But nevertheless, the motives about why things were done aren't enough to set aside what a hypothetical, fair-minded lay observer might think, because they can't see into the minds of the people. They just look at what it looks like based on what they know, and they're assumed to know quite a lot. What did Acting Justice Kay say about this face-crackingly awkward exchange? At paragraph 302, he said, the phrase boring Tedeschi referred to senior counsel who represented the plaintiff in the inquiry. The fact that Mr. Sofronov felt it appropriate to express such a view to Ms. Olbrichtson about a counsel appearing before him is again a minor point, but nevertheless one which would be relevant to the perception of a fair-minded observer. The comment went beyond conveying information to a journalist, but indicated that he felt comfortable to express such a view about counsel to Ms. Olbrichtson, particularly counsel who was appearing for the plaintiff. The lawyers for the plaintiff in this matter, the plaintiff being the former DPP, put together some summaries of the amount of communications that various journalists had with Mr. Sofronov. His Honour talks about the plaintiff's reliance on the quantity and nature of communications between Mr. Sofronov and Ms. Olbrichtson. And in paragraph 137 of his judgment, he talks about what the plaintiff put forward there. He said, counsel noted that the material establishes that from the time that Mr. Sofronov was appointed, he was in contact with Ms. Olbrichtson. Between 9 February and 2 August 2023, he engaged in 91 telephone calls with journalists, 51 of which were with Ms. Olbrichtson, and 22 of which were with Mr. Thomas. I'll just jump in here. Mr. Thomas is a colleague of Ms. Olbrichtson and introduced her to Mr. Sofronov. The 91 telephone calls were for a total of 13 hours and 37 minutes. The telephone calls with Ms. Olbrichtson were for 6 hours and 19 minutes, and with Mr. Thomas for 5 hours and 8 minutes. By contrast, the telephone calls with all other journalists during that period occupied a total of 2 hours and 10 minutes. In the course of the public hearings between 8 May and 1 June 2023, Mr. Sofronov engaged in 10 telephone calls with the Australian newspaper, that's where Ms. Olbrichtson works, 8 of which were with Ms. Olbrichtson, and no telephone calls with any other members of the media. Further, between 7 April and 31 July 2023, Mr. Sofronov had 31 telephone contacts with the Australian newspaper, 27 of which were with Ms. Olbrichtson, and during that period had no such contacts with any other journalist. So His Honour is pretty clear that there was an unusual, or perhaps we would say disproportionate, amount of contact with Ms. Olbrichtson versus other journalists. He doesn't say disproportionate. That's just me trying to put it into probably not very lay terms, to be honest. But anyway, you get the gist, I am very sure. His Honour also noted that at para 143, counsel noted Mr. Sofronov had 4 different email addresses. Ms. Olbrichtson used one of those addresses on 8 occasions when she forwarded particularly sensitive information to Mr. Sofronov. Counsel asked rhetorically if the communications between them were all appropriate / above board, why would Ms. Olbrichtson and Mr. Sofronov use that one particular email address to be providing documents and information to Mr. Sofronov? So His Honour is just repeating the argument made there by counsel. He's not saying he necessarily agrees with it or anything, but he's saying this was the argument that was made. And I would point you to the fact that there were guidelines with one email address on it, and this one that's being spoken about in paragraph 143 is clearly not that email address. In fact, they used four different email addresses to communicate, or Mr. Sofronov had four different email addresses. So, again, His Honour is not saying that Mr. Sofronov or Ms. Ulbrichtsen did anything wrong. He's just saying, would the hypothetical fair-minded lay observer worry that there might be bias? Now, he's saying there is an unusual and high level of communication going on. It's unusual because it's not in line with the guidelines set out for communication with the media. It's unusual because of the content, and you saw that spelled out by His Honour when he took us to the arguments made on behalf of the plaintiff about the amount of time spent discussing the matter on the telephone with various. Now, these are just some of the many things to which His Honour had regard. I'll point to a few more. But before I do that, I want to make it really clear. His Honour is not saying that anything wrong was in fact done by Mr. Sofronov or Ms. Ulbrichtsen. But he does say, there were also some aspects of the means by which Mr. Sofronov and Ms. Ulbrichtsen communicated with each other which would be relevant to the considerations of the fair-minded observer. At para 306, he says, at an early stage, 15 March 2023, Mr. Sofronov, at the request of Ms. Ulbrichtsen, provided to her his private email address. Mr. Sofronov's willingness to provide that address to Ms. Ulbrichtsen would be viewed in the context of the media protocol guidelines that had been disseminated to the media, and also in light of the circumstance that it would seem Mr. Sofronov had other official email addresses which he was using. There were a lot of other instances that His Honour referred to when he carefully considered whether the fair-minded lay observer might have some worry that bias was on foot. And again, he didn't find that it was. He found that it might be something that would concern the fair lay observer. Ultimately, he did have to hold the concern not only that there might be some bias because of the level of communication, but he had to also consider what the bias might be, because it is well and good to say, well, this person seems to have an unusual level of access and to have the confidence of the Board of Inquiry such that Mr. Sofronov feels comfortable telling this journalist about his views, his private views that don't have anything to do with the outcome of the inquiry, about, you know, whether counsel was boring, or to say essentially, hey, thanks for pointing out that issue. That's a good thought in relation to lines of questioning that weren't asked on a particular day. So to spell it out for you, and not by any means in the way that the judge has made his findings, it's that it looks like there's a relationship where there could be some influence and regard between these two people, such that one might be able to influence the other. And of course, that influence doesn't actually have to have happened. It's just that the fair-minded lay observer might think, oh, that could have. So in terms of the actual bias, though, the content of which the fair-minded lay observer might think the Board of Inquiry was swayed, obviously there's no swaying if the person who has the influence is favourable to the defendant. So the court had to look at whether the influence would be a bias against Mr. Drumgold. And so in summary, the court did accept the argument put forward by the plaintiff's lawyers, and this was made on the basis of a lot of evidence that they had collated, that Ms. Albrechtsen's reporting was uniformly negative in relation to Mr. Drumgold. And I'll take you to some commentary by His Honour on this issue. His Honour made some findings in relation to the types of articles that Ms. Albrechtsen wrote. He had to read a lot of them. And at paragraph 232, he said, in essence, having reviewed the articles in question, it is clear that Ms. Albrechtsen consistently expressed views that were particularly critical of the plaintiff in his decision to commence the criminal proceedings against Mr. Lehrman and in his conduct of those proceedings. Relevantly, the conclusion is irresistible that a fair-minded lay observer, having read the articles, would have readily understood that Ms. Albrechtsen expressed firm and considered views that were significantly critical of the plaintiff in those respects. Further, he says at paragraph 270, further, as a material objective fact, a fair-minded observer would take into account that Ms. Albrechtsen's views, as expressed in the articles published by her, could not be characterized superficial or unreasoned. Rather, the articles were clearly the product of substantial research undertaken by Ms. Albrechtsen and were based on a significant amount of information that was apparently available to her. A number of those articles were quite lengthy and detailed in their content. A fair-minded observer acquainted with the articles written by Ms. Albrechtsen would understand that she was well immersed in the background and the circumstances of the prosecution of the case against Mr. Lehrman, and would understand that Ms. Albrechtsen held considered and firm views relating to that matter, which were significantly critical of the plaintiff. His Honour further says at para 271, in those circumstances, it is, I consider, particularly relevant that when Mr. Sofronov first met with Ms. Albrechtsen, he had been informed that she held views and had published articles that were very much adverse to the plaintiff. Now, His Honour is not saying you can't talk to journalists who take an adverse view in relation to someone involved in a matter, but he's saying in this case the nature, circumstances, quantity of the communications might give rise to apprehended bias. Further, he pulls it all together. His Honour Acting Justice K talks about an exchange between Mr. Sofronov and Ms. Albrechtsen in relation to an affidavit that was made by a junior solicitor named Mr. Grieg, and some adverse findings were made by the Board of Inquiry in relation to Mr. Drumgold about that issue. Please go to the week's episode if you want to know more. It's a very good episode, as I say. So in paragraph 297, he says the plaintiff was due to commence his evidence, which would no doubt have included addressing that issue 2 days later. It was clear from the message that Mr. Sofronov sent to Ms. Albrechtsen on 6 May that he then held a view that was adverse to the plaintiff in respect of that issue. That point of itself, of course, does not mean that he had prejudged or predetermined the issue. However, the point that is of particular relevance is that a fair-minded observer would be significantly concerned that Mr. Sofronov saw fit to communicate that assessment that he had made about the plaintiff to Ms. Albrechtsen, particularly in circumstances in which he knew that Ms. Albrechtsen held views that were critical of the plaintiff. The fair-minded observer might fairly apprehend that at that point Mr. Sofronov regarded himself as a fellow traveller of Ms. Albrechtsen in respect of the views that she had expressed and maintained in her publications about the plaintiff. The observer might also apprehend that, as such, Mr. Sofronov regarded it as appropriate to exchange views with Ms. Albrechtsen about specific issues which he was required to determine in the inquiry. So that's really the crux of it. All of the circumstances give rise to an apprehension that maybe Mr. Sofronov regarded himself as a fellow traveller of Ms. Albrechtsen. They might have worried about the fact that he seemed to think it was appropriate to exchange these views with Ms. Albrechtsen about specific issues that he was required to make decisions about. So it's really on that basis, but having regard to a whole lot more communications that Acting Justice Kay came to the decision that he did. I've told you the most sort of interesting ones. Look, they did have a lunch prior to the Board of Inquiry, but as Justice Kay has rightly pointed out, there's nothing improper about that. Counsel assisting the inquiry was there. There's nothing untoward about meeting someone to get an introduction to them, and for them to perhaps find out about how the inquiry is structured and looking like it might run. That seems like a pretty sensible way for a journalist to obtain that information if they have the guts to make such a request. And if, as Mr. Sofronov is, the head of the Board of Inquiry is minded to be as cooperative as possible with the media, and we know that Mr. Sofronov is because he explained in his affidavit that he takes very seriously the need for the public to feel informed about what's going on in an inquiry, because that will build trust in the legal system. So he says that was his thinking behind being so open with journalists and having such a high level of contact with them. His Honour, having read and fairly considered the affidavit of Mr. Sofronov, he wanted to make some specific comments about that to show that he had considered those things. He said in paragraph 323 and 322, in fact, in his ruling, Mr. Sofronov made it plain that both he and counsel assisting had freely engaged with journalists to ensure that they could obtain a full understanding of the evidence and the significance and ramifications of it. Mr. Sofronov explained that he and counsel assisting had done so in order that the community was properly informed about the work of the inquiry. At para 323, His Honour says, in the present proceeding, it was not an issue that the kind of contact spoken about by Mr. Sofronov on 10 May could give rise to any reasonable apprehension of bias from the perspective of a fair-minded observer. However, it is quite clear from the context in which the ruling was delivered by Mr. Sofronov that the kind of engagement which he spoke about in that ruling was significantly less than and different from the quantity, nature, content, and circumstances of the communication in which he engaged with Ms. Albrechtsen, leading up to and during the inquiry. In my view, a fair-minded observer acquainted with the ruling given by Mr. Sofronov on 10 May could not have understood that the kind of engagement that he then spoke about encompassed the extent and nature of the communication that he did in fact undertake with Ms. Albrechtsen. He says at paragraph 324, in that respect, it may be observed that the extent and nature of the communications undertaken by Mr. Sofronov with Ms. Albrechtsen in the present case was qualitatively and quantitatively different to that which had been undertaken in the course of the landmark Fitzgerald inquiry to which Mr. Sofronov referred in his affidavit. In that inquiry, it appears that the chairman, Mr. Fitzgerald, frequently addressed media in hearings of the commission in order to ensure that the community was not misled by the reporting of the work, by the media reporting of the work of the inquiry. So he's saying, well, you told us in your affidavit that you wanted to be transparent, and you said in a ruling early in the proceedings on 10 May that you were going to be open about things because justice and community
confidence required it, but what you actually did in communications with Ms. Albrechtson in terms of like the sheer number of them and the scope of them, the content of them, is not what anyone hearing you say that in court would have understood you to be meaning. So His Honour found it, paragraph 337. I'm driven to the conclusion in this case that a fair-minded observer acquainted with all the material objective facts of the case might reasonably have apprehended that as a consequence of his communications with Ms. Albrechtson, Mr. Sofronov might have been influenced and thus biased against the plaintiff in determining the issues. So there you go. That's a brief overview of the evidence and arguments relied upon in relation to apprehended bias. There were actually a number of other grounds that were put forward as reasons why there was apprehended bias, but they didn't actually succeed. But the nature, content, circumstances, etc. of the communications with journalist Janet Albrechtson were sufficient to establish that a hypothetical fair-minded lay observer might reasonably apprehend bias. So there you go. What can we take away from this? Well, as we discussed earlier, decisions about apprehended bias are not precedents for any other matter because they all have to turn on their facts. But we got a handy chat about the legal principles involved in this judgment, so that's useful if you want to come back to that at any point. And we got some pretty interesting illustrations of all of the bits and pieces that went together to lead to this finding of apprehended bias. And it's really important to remember this is not a finding of actual bias. It's just one that it's a finding that the fair-minded lay observer might be worried that there is bias. And there's some very awkward scenarios also outlined in this judgment about whether or not particular counsel are interesting or not in court. And, that one stings, I tell you what. Thank you so much for listening. I wanted to get this out today so that people could understand the fullness of the judgment because it's more complicated than I expect a lot of media reporting will discuss. And it's quite interesting. Thank you so much for listening to this breaking news episode of the Not Just a Lawyer podcast. I read the judgment so you don't have to, but no, seriously, if you're a lawyer and you want to rely on it, of course, read the judgment. My goodness, read the judgment. Equally, if you're a journalist, read the judgment. But if you're just a layperson, maybe that hypothetical, fair-minded lay observer, I've tried to break it down so you can understand what's going on and what sort of things the judge really had to take into account. I take you behind the headlines into the actual detail. So I hope you enjoyed it. Bye.